Romans 3, 1 to 20. So the Jewish boast of righteousness through possessing the law and possessing circumcision ring hollow, because the response of faith that both these things demanded, the law and circumcision, was lacking. Now the hypocrisy of such boasting is exposed by the fact that the Gentiles who believe the gospel enact the requirements of the law and enjoy the true comfort and strength and joy of circumcision. So true Jewishness is established by faith, independent of any external or national privilege. That's what we just looked at in chapter 2. Now this begs the question of verse 1 of chapter 3. What advantage then is there in being a Jew? Or what value in circumcision? Well, the second question points out what's at stake in the first question. Circumcision. What value in circumcision? Well, circumcision symbolizes God's unconditional promise to the people of Israel. Therefore, the advantage of circumcision doesn't rest in the hands of men, but on the promise of God. So if circumcision is profitless, then so is God's promise. See, if circumcision is of no advantage to the Jews, then one of two unthinkable conclusions must follow. Either God's a liar, and circumcision doesn't mean anything, or the Old Testament is an unfaithful witness to him. That if circumcision is of no value and being a Jew means nothing. So therefore, behind these questions of verse 1 is not just a petty objection to Paul's thesis so far. No, in verses 1 to 4, Paul is vindicating God's integrity. Is God a liar or not? Has he lied to the Jews? Well, verse 2, of course, the Jews have an advantage. What advantage is there being a Jew? Much in every way. Now, some people say that we should be surprised at Paul's positive answer. So, C.H. Dodd, whose commentary is you could go and read it if you wanted to. But he comes out with his classic comment. He says, the logical answer on the basis of Paul's argument so far is none whatever. There's no advantage of being a Jew. But of course Paul's argued nothing of the sort. No, he's only argued that without faith, circumcision is useless. Now circumcision itself was of enormous value, because through the sacrament of circumcision, the gospel had been proclaimed first to the Jew. So in fact, in the whole Old Testament, the very words of God had been proclaimed. The gospel had been proclaimed to the Jews for centuries. Now, if that's not an advantage, then nothing is. You'd have a 1,500-year head start on the rest of the world. But verse 3, the problem was that the Jews had not taken advantage of their advantage. They had been given this advantage, but they just let it sit there and did nothing with it. See, circumcision is an invitation to faith. It says, come on, trust the Lord. Trust the God who justifies the wicked. We'll come on to that glorious phrase later on in chapter 4. Yet, as Paul reminds us here, obviously, in verse 2, some did not have faith. So verse 3, some did not have faith. So hadn't God's covenant failed? I mean, if his promises to Israel were unfulfilled as long as Israel did not respond to them, he must be a liar. His promise must be worthless. Well, that's the logic behind verse 3. But of course, this logic is preposterous blasphemy. Verse 4. See, God's faithfulness does not depend on our faith. Now, God's covenant is not a contract between two relative interdependent parties. You know, we can't put God in our debt. We don't do a few things and say, okay, God, you owe me now. It's never a contract. I mean, that is blasphemous. Righteousness is only ever a free gift given by God, totally independent of any merit in us. So to suggest that God's faithfulness is contingent upon our faith, as the legalistic Jews had done in chapter 2, is to deny God's sovereignty over and against man and to reduce him to the level of a mere player in our religious games. And that's sheer impudence. See, God cannot be changed or compromised by our truth-suppressing rebellion. Rather, his truth is the great given. The great given of all thinking and everything is that God is true. Calvin says on this, he says, the first proposition of all Christian philosophy, the primary axiom is this: let God be true and every man a liar. So that's where we start from. So it doesn't matter what a human being does. It doesn't matter what we do. God is true. If we do anything different from it, what does that make us? Well, it doesn't make us sort of interesting people with a different view. It doesn't have any integrity. It's sheer impudent wickedness. Let God be true and every man a liar. I love that phrase. It's disconcerting, isn't it? Let God be true and every man a liar. And if we look at that, it comes from Psalm 116, verses 10 to 11, where the psalmist says, I believed, so he's talking from the position of faith, I believed, therefore I said, I am greatly afflicted, and in my dismay I said, all men are liars. So from the point of view of faith, the psalmist sees man's true nature. We're all liars. We're all liars. So Paul, what he's calling here for in Romans 3 is for the faithful to proclaim, in response to the godless logic of verse 3, the logic of verse 3 which says, God can't be true. If I don't take him up on his offer, well, what's his offer all about? No, in response to that, we've got to say, let God be true and every man a liar, even if that means condemning ourselves. We should rejoice to condemn ourselves so long as God is proclaimed as true and we are a liar. So Paul cites Psalm 51 here in verse 4. Not at all. Let God be true and every man a liar, as it is written, so that you may be proved right when you speak and prevail when you judge. Psalm 51. Do you remember it? It's where the Psalm of David's repentance after he's committed adultery with Bathsheba and had Uriah, her husband, murdered. Well, do you remember what David says in Psalm 51 verse 3, just before this bit that Paul quotes? He says, and it's a strange thing to say, against you, Lord, you only have I sinned. False, David. You're lying. You've sinned against Bathsheba. You've sinned against Uriah. No, says David, against you, Lord, only have I sinned. Because ultimately, sin is an affront against God. See, it's God's faithfulness and truth that defines adultery and murder as horrific. And David knows it. And he acknowledges it so that he acknowledges it publicly. He says, against you have I sinned, I am a scumbag, so that you may be proclaimed as being right, even at the expense of my own integrity. So that you may be proved right when you speak and prevail when you judge. So in condemning himself by the rule of God's truth, David is declaring that God is just, even as he is condemning him. So David isn't into playing religious games with God. He just says, let God be true, and if that means I'm a liar, so be it. So the Jews have been given an enormous advantage, the faithful promise of God. Yet, by seeking to establish a righteousness of their own through the law and national privilege, they had turned the promise of God into a contract. And such rebellion against the truth and faithfulness of God is in itself their condemnation. So if God gives you all these things and says, here you go, here's my truth, you disagree with it, you're stuffed. You don't do what it requires, you're stuffed. It doesn't matter what you feel about that, that's just the way it is. God remains unimpeached. He always remains unimpeached. This is a great quote from Karl Barth's commentary on this verse. Above the rise and fall of the waves of human history, in spite of human infidelity, aye, in this very infidelity itself, there remains the faithfulness of God. And there remains also the advantage which the Jews received but did not possess. It's a great quote. It's funny, isn't it? Let God be true and every man a liar. You know, at the end of the 20th century, the most horrific century of all in terms of ethnic cleansing and, you know, wickedness reaches a scale in the 20th century which it's hard to believe we can actually get through another century at that rate. Yet, what's the great intellectual problem at the end of the 20th century? It's a theological problem. That's what people say. I don't believe there can be a God when there's such terrible suffering and cruelty in the world. How dare we? How dare we? It's an anthropological problem. The question should be, how can we possibly believe in humanity at the end of a century like that? But we turn it on its head because we refuse the logic of let God be true and every man a liar. Okay, verse 5. Now, Paul realizes that the godless could draw false inferences from verses 1 to 4. See, because God's truth defies human truth suppression, do you get that? Because God is true, how do we know we're truth suppressors? Well, because we disagree with God. So, if God's truth defines human truth suppression, then it is true, verse 5, that, in a sense, our unrighteousness does bring out God's righteousness more clearly. As we're unrighteous, God, we begin to see how righteous God is. So, of course, the logic works. You know, the logic of this verse actually does work. Maybe God is unjust, verse 5, in bringing his wrath on us. You know, we're doing him a favour. We're sort of, it's a kind of a I'll scratch your back, you scratch mine arrangement. If we're a bit more unrighteous, God will be seen as being a bit more righteous. Then, you know, surely it's just fair play if he leaves us alone to be even more unrighteous so he can be shown to be the more righteous. That's the logic. And actually, it's quite good logic. If you're human. I'm using a human argument. After chapter 1, verses 18 to 32, we realise that Paul doesn't probably have a lot of time for human arguments. See, it's a disastrous method of arguing because it ignores the axiom, Calvin's first axiom of Christian thought. Let God be true and every man a liar. A human argument is by definition wrong, false. So Paul reestablishes the great given in verse 6. See, the fact that God is righteous, is the righteous judge of the world, is not open to question. That is not an issue on the table for debate. That is the given. That's where we start from. God simply cannot be unrighteous in punishing sinners because he just is the just, righteous judge of the world. Another quote from Barth on this. Barth's awesome on this. He says, in speaking of God, he's talking about human arguments. He has a rage on human arguments. And he says, in speaking of God, human logic characteristically ignores both his nature and the fact that when the reference is to him, the argument from operation to cause is inapplicable, since he is not a known thing in a series of things. In other words, he is the beginning of all things from which we must argue. You cannot come from another starting point and then go, so I start from the point of view human beings are right, come over here and then start waving my fist at God. No. We start by denouncing ourselves, proclaiming that God's true, and look at the world from that angle instead. Okay, so the argument in verse 5, yes, it's logical, but it's deeply wicked. Okay, verse 7. So having conclusively destroyed the false conclusion, verse 5 just says, I'm sorry, Paul restates them to show up the true extent of their folly. This is amazing. See, it is absurd to suggest that human sin can enhance God's truthfulness and so increase his glory. I mean, that's the logic, isn't it? Again, if I carry on sinning and the more I'm a liar, the more God will be shown as being true. Let's get on with evil then. It's an amazing thing. I mean, absurd, perverse. I mean, yeah, God can be glorified in bringing good out of situations created by human sinfulness. Yet to do so is up to him. It's his sovereign decision. No, man's sin, even if it is used for glorious purposes, is still damnable sin. Let God be true and every man a liar. And then in verse 8, Paul pushes the foolish inference to its logical conclusion. Let us do evil, that good may result. Classic human argument, isn't it? Suppressing the truth. We refuse to stand on the truth and start from there. And so you end up by saying, let's just multiply wickedness in order to bring about good. Unbelievable. And some of Paul's critics were accusing Paul of promoting evil behavior in the name of godliness. Look at these people. Why not say, as we are being slanderously reported as saying, and as some claim we say, let us do good that evil may result, their condemnation is deserved. Actually, that's quite an incredible accusation against Paul, isn't it? I mean, particularly after chapter 1, verses 18 to 32, the idea that Paul could possibly condone wickedness for a second. Yet, human argument again. Human argument against the gospel. It's ridiculous. So Paul is not compromised by his message. No, as in the case of the unfaithful Jews, it is those who refuse to let God be true and every man a liar who end up dashed on the rock of his condemnation. Okay, verse 9, Paul begins to wrap up the argument he's been pursuing from chapter 2, verse 1. Remember the Jews. The Jews have been arguing and saying, we don't fit into that grand condemnation of humanity in the second half of chapter 1. We're not that. Oh, really? See, the Jews resisted the universal judgment of the gospel, but Paul has disarmed their claims to righteousness through possessing the law and through circumcision. And in 3 verse 1, Paul establishes that these privileges were a real advantage. He says, yes, it was good that you had circumcision and you had the law. They really are advantages. But the Jews had not taken advantage of them by faith. So in that case, were they any better off with regard to God's judgment than the Gentiles? Well, Paul's answer is no. Verse 9, what should we conclude then? Are we, Jews, any better? Remember, Paul's a Jew. Are we any better? Not at all. We have already made the charge that Jew and Gentile alike are all under sin. So he hasn't reached a conclusion. In the sense, he hasn't been arguing towards this point to say that Jews are condemned as well. No, he's been arguing from this point. He started at the beginning of 2, saying everybody's condemned. And he's just done a little foray round to make sure they realise that. And then he says, okay, you are. You really are condemned. All of you. All mankind shares a common nature. We are all under sin. Isn't that a chilling phrase in verse 9? We are all under sin. So all mankind shares a common nature. Mere external privilege does not change the fact that we are ruled not by righteousness, but by sin. See, the way Paul personifies sin as this tyrant under whose rule we willingly subjected ourselves. We are all under sin. He doesn't just say we are all controlled by sin or we all do sin. We are all under sin, as if sin has got us. So the tyrant sin perverts every action for its own ends and enforces its rule by its terrifying henchman, death. So Jews, just as much as Gentiles, stand hopelessly condemned in sin. And the scriptures confirm it. Here, this collection of Old Testament quotations makes the point very powerfully. I love this quote. It's very sort of frilly and Victorian from Bishop Moule. His commentary, he says, the fragments large and dark come from diverse quarries. But Paul knits these fragments together to form a new whole, a new unit made up of three stanzas. It's a sort of a three-verse poem. No, it's not a poem, really. But anyway, so the stanzas are verses 10 and 12. That's the first one. Second one, verses 13 and 14. And the third one, verses 15 to 18. Now, the first stanza includes quotations from Ecclesiastes 2, Psalm 14, and Psalm 53. And in each case, the original writers were explicitly speaking in universal terms. So the Lord looked down from heaven on the sons of men, in other words, on everybody, to see if there was any who understand. But there is no one, neither Jew nor Gentile, who's righteous, no one. So Paul begins with a verdict against sinners. There's no one righteous. Sin is sin, not because it is immoral or antisocial, but because it's theological. It's defined in relation to God. It's a matter of righteousness. Are we in right relationship with God? No one is. No one righteous. See, the problem with sin, with being under sin, is not primarily that life may be miserable. The way people present the gospel, often that's the way it's presented, that, you know, there's a God-shaped hole in your life. You need God because you need to get your life sorted out. Well, that may be true. But it's not the real issue. The real issue is unrighteousness. God will condemn us because we're out of relationship with him. Now, the psalmist observed then exactly the same as what Paul did. There is no one righteous, not even one. The wrath of God is being revealed from the heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. It's the same story. All under sin. So sin is the rejection of God that characterizes the whole of our fallen race. It is a willful turning away from God in order to serve ourselves. Our wills are bent upon God, on self as opposed to God. So everything we do is motivated by opposition to God. Just those words in that opening stanza, no one. They have together become worthless. No one, not even one, no one. No one, the whole world is condemned. But I mean, surely that's a bit harsh. You know, doesn't the beauty of the B minor mass, the generosity of Bande, the sincerity of the Buddhist monk vindicate some people, at least some of the time? Of course not. No, all actions and thoughts that are not motivated by love of Jesus Christ and faith in him are acts of rebellion against him. And that means all our thoughts are actions. And that's the doctrine of total depravity. Total depravity. Every area of our activity and thought is inevitably perverted by sin. Okay, so the first stanza proves from Scripture that all alike are under sin, Jews and Gentiles, everybody. But the second and third stanzas show us that it really does apply to the Jews as well as to the Gentiles. This is really hard. This is tough. See, verses 13 and 14 cite three psalms in which, not the speech of everybody in the world, but the speech of the Israelites specifically is condemned. You can follow up the references later. So the symptoms of universal sin were felt just as much in Jerusalem as they were in Babylon or Nineveh. Murderous lies, mutual deception, blasphemy. Isn't it significant that Paul focuses on the Jews' speech in this context? Do you remember, they have been entrusted with the very words of God. God spoke his truth to them specifically. So the fact that they, of all people, had perverse speech is perfect condemnation. It is perfect confirmation that they are under sin like everyone else. Third stanza focuses on Israel's actions. So we've had Israel's speech. Third stanza, Israel's actions. Now verses 15 to 17 come from Isaiah 59, where the prophet is rebuking Judah for neglecting the law. You know, instead of caring about justice and peace, violence reigned. The Israelites were eager to murder. Look at that, verse 15. Their feet are swift to shed blood. So murder isn't a last option. No, it's the first thing they do. They're swift to shed blood. The wicked left a trail of destruction wherever they went, refusing to make peace. Now, of course, the law ruled against all of this, yet to no effect, because Jews as well as Gentiles are under sin. Now, Paul's final quotation from Psalm 36, verse 1, rounds off his collection by referring back to the beginning of it. All men turn away from Christ, verses 10 to 12. But whilst the Gentiles had suppressed creation's sermon, the sermon of creation, the Gentiles had suppressed that, the Jews, in addition, had rejected the sermon of the Old Testament. So they, more than anyone, should have feared the Lord. Yet there is no fear of God before their eyes. So verse 19, the Jews believed that possessing the law set them above everyone else. But the truth points in the opposite direction. Possessing the law actually makes the Jews the definitive study on sin. They are the definitive study on sin. See, they're not exempt from the condemnation of all humanity as truth suppressors that we had. No, they are the worked example par excellence of truth suppression. But we can't mock. We can't stand back and say, oh, they got it wrong, they mucked it up. No. Their failure is the measure of our guilt. The Old Testament, their failure with the law, is like a ruler put against the side of our sinful nature saying, this is how sinful you are, because you'd have done exactly the same. See, if we learn the lesson from the Jews and their privileges, verse 19, every mouth will be silenced, and the whole world held accountable to God. So verse 20, it's absurd that the Jews tried to become justified by the works of the law. Now, of course, if rightly understood, we've said this already this morning, the law was a proclamation of the gospel because it taught people to trust Christ that we may be justified by faith. But if it is attempted as this series of hoops to jump through, like a sort of program of good works to get saved, it's deadly. Absolutely deadly. See, through the law, God's verdict on humanity is pronounced. We are guilty sinners. And the more the Jews attempted the law without faith, the sterner the verdict became. See, far from promoting arrogant self-righteousness, the law should have given rise to self-abasement and faith. But of course it didn't. So the works of the law will justify no one. That's quite important in verse 20, where it says, no one will be justified and declared righteous sight by observing the law. The NIV hasn't helped us. It's a phrase Paul uses quite a lot in Romans. The works of the law, as opposed to the real thing the law requires, which is belief. So no one will be justified by the works of the law. Okay, so the judgment of the gospel is universal. No one is exempt, especially the Jews. In fact, the reason Paul has spent so long looking at their case is that the profundity of their unrighteousness is the measure of what needs to be overcome if God is to offer a righteousness that is by faith from first to last. See, not only must wrath be dealt with, no, people have to be totally transformed. More later.